From KCRW in Santa Monica, I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner, and this is The Business.
So you still want to do the show business, and you think that you got what it takes? I mean, you really got to rap and be all that, and prepare yourself for the breaks. Check it out.
This week on The Business, do salacious rumors swirling about NBC's embattled programming chief signal his ouster? What has he done that's so bad? And what good is being overlooked? Plus, in a world without Don LaFontaine. But first, it's the Hollywood News Caravan. Go nowhere. It's The Business from NPR. Hollywood's Geiger counters started clicking loudly after Wall Street's reactor core began an accelerated meltdown last week. The financial crisis may not seem like a Hollywood ending, but it is of a kind. It marks the beginning of the end of easy Wall Street money for Tinseltown. Amazingly, Variety reports mixed reaction from the media moguls. Some, like Roop and Jeffrey Katzenberg, see opportunities for Hollywood in tough economic times. Of course, we're not just facing tough economic times here. What fantastic timing for the petro moguls of the Arabian Gulf who just happened to have arrived with cash in hand. 2 weeks ago, state-owned Abu Dhabi Media set up a $250 million fund in partnership with Participant Productions, which has financed the socially conscious and not exactly fossil fuel-friendly films like Inconvenient Truth and Syriana. Last week, Abu Dhabi Media made headlines again, announcing a plan for two more partnerships with Western companies that would, quote, broadly be similar in structure to the one with Participant Media, end quote. This according to the company's chief executive. Finally, the Screen Actors Guild contract with the studios expired at the end of June, but a strike never developed, at least not yet, because of, quel choc, infighting amongst the leadership of the largest actors' union. Last week, that infighting appeared to evaporate. SAG polled its membership on whether the union should accept the producer's, quote, last, best, and final offer, and their answer was a resounding no. In fact, 87% responded that SAG should keep bargaining, though they were asked a rather loaded question, namely, should SAG continue negotiating with the studios to secure, quote, a fair contract? I mean, they should negotiate for an unfair contract? It's also worth noting that just under 10% of SAG's membership responded to the poll, a fact producers seized upon, calling the whole thing, quote, a farce. However, that 10% could still be significant, since only about 20% of actors ever vote on actual contracts. Insiders say the impasse is largely about internet residuals. You can see why the actors might want to hold out for web money, given the lousy deal they made on DVD residuals all those years ago, a deal which still haunts them today. In fact, a new report from NPD Group found that while DVD sales may be flattening, 8 out of every $10 spent on video entertainment still comes from DVD. Finally, speaking of DVDs, rental giant Netflix is sponsoring a competition to set a new Guinness World Record for most consecutive hours spent watching movies in Times Square. The previous record, of course, was set in 1977, when a man named Bob spent 6 days holed up in a Peoporama video booth watching Brazier to Eternity. And that's the Hollywood News Caravan. Coming up next, ask not for whom the bell tolls. It tolls for thee, Ben Silverman. In May of 2007, a guy named Ben Silverman was hired as the new programming chief of the woeful NBC network. The move seemed inspired. After all, he appeared to be a programming genius. Silverman had brought The Office and Ugly Betty to the States and had a finger in importing American Idol as well. He'd produced successful reality shows like The Biggest Loser and produced Showtime's period drama, The Tudors. But Silverman never had to deal with the politics of running a network. He was known to be a very ADD type of guy and had a reputation for fast living. More significantly, his production company, Reveille, was still doing a lot of business with NBC, leading to claims of conflict of interest. Less than a year and a half after he ascended to the Peacock throne, the town is clucking about a premature plucking. Are rumors of his demise greatly exaggerated? Has he gotten a raw deal? Has NBC? Kim Masters is NPR's entertainment business correspondent. Kim Masters, welcome back to The Business.
Thank you.
So Ben Silverman's persona and his background are very different from most normal, if we want to use that word, around Hollywood, than most normal network television chiefs. How is he different? And what does that say about how things were going at NBC when they chose to hire someone that different?
Well, I think when Jeff Zucker chose to hire him, they were sort of chasing a guy they perceived as a young, hot talent, which is dangerous in this business because you're not sure what you're going to get. He is a guy who had a big reputation as a party boy. He was a producer, talent friendly. He was very different. I remember when he was first going to come and appear before the television critics when they gather annually, we were wondering if he would actually put on a jacket or a tie. And, you know, most of the network chiefs are pretty sober, adult-type men.
To suggest that he's a drunk. But by sober, you
tread
mean serious.
Carefully. Yes, I mean, serious.
And, of course, when he showed up, it was jacket but no tie.
Yes, he compromised with the powers that be, I think.
So what kind of shape was NBC in such that they had to go get this kind of guy?
Well, they haven't been in good shape for a long time. You know, their great shows aged, like Friends is the most famous one, and they groped and tried to find a replacement and didn't succeed for a long time. And then they tried all sorts of stunts or some sort of programming gimmick. But basically, NBC just couldn't find that new hit. You know, they had some stuff like that worked, but a lot of stuff that didn't. So He seemed like a guy who could get NBC back into something other than the basement.
But he'd never done anything like this before. He started out really as a talent agent and then sort of selling formats, right?
Exactly.
I mean, basically, here's the show that we have on in Britain and you're going to have it now in the States. And,
right.
And he would make those deals happen.
And, you know, famously coupling the British sitcom. That was such a debacle.
Yes.
And the then head of NBC, Kevin Reilly, gave him a chance with The Office and championed The Office and ended up getting thrown out of his job as a payback.
Be careful who you're nice to.
Yes, exactly.
But Mr. Silverman was already astonishingly rich. I mean, I understand from various reports that he's made as much as $30 million just from selling The Office to NBC. So why would he take a job as head of a network where there seems to be so much public attention, so many slings and arrows? It seems like he has a lot more to lose than to gain, right?
If I have to guess, I'd guess hubris. Or maybe, if you want to put it more benignly, he thought it might be fun or it might be challenging. I mean, Ben Silverman makes a very impressive presentation. He's quite a salesman. And despite this kind of hyperactive affect of his, he can really seem to sort of fire out numbers and fire out ideas. And I can see where he might have thought, I can do this. You know, I noticed when I interviewed him when he first got the job that whenever he talked about any of his shows, he was talking about I did The Office. I brought Ugly Betty. I did the Tudors on Showtime. And you sort of thought, really? All by yourself? And so he talked about his love of television as a boy and his admiration for Norman Lear and All in the Family and what a wonderful social thing that was. And he hasn't done much of that in the job. But I think he kind of thought it would maybe that it would be easier and less demanding than it turns out to be.
Was there anything about his transition into the Peacock executive suite that set the tone for his tenure?
First of all, there was immediate speculation on the internet as to whether or not Ben Silverman was going to pass his drug test and whether or not they were delaying to see whether Ben had a chance to make sure he would pass the drug test. And that was, you know, there's been so much speculation about this. And then, of course, there was the pre-Emmy party that he gave where there was literally a tiger at this house. And he has all sorts of – there were parties with these scantily clad models. And, you know, he had this reputation. He would wear a marijuana leaf emblem on his shirts. You know, so he definitely not only had a reputation but kind of stoked that reputation as he came into the job.
So let's talk about the first few days even leading up to his hire. What happens or what goes wrong?
Well, the story leaks, and it seems that the deal isn't quite done, and there's great haste on NBC's part to get this deal cobbled together, and that deal has been fraught with problems. And meanwhile, Kevin Reilly, the well-liked and well-regarded head of NBC Entertainment at that time, was reading about this without having been told. And so there was a certain amount of resentment in the community that this person who's perceived as sort of an extraordinarily fortunate young man ousted someone who I think people felt was well-regarded, as I said.
So let's talk about this financial relationship that Ben Silverman has to NBC just before his hire. He owns at the time a company called Reveille, which has subsequently been sold for $200 million. But at the time, it is really kind of a nettlesome issue in his hire. Why? What's the problem? What does it set him up for criticism for?
Well, he wants to hold on to his interest in this company, and NBC stunningly lets him. And they work out some sort of trust arrangement, but there were gigantic gaping loopholes where he stood to profit financially from shows that he was putting on NBC's air.
You say stunningly why? Because?
Well, because NBC is part of GE, which is not only a publicly held company where conflicts of interest are supposed to be frowned upon, but and GE is supposed to be one of the more rigorous enforcers of the rules in these situations. And this, you know, that you can look it up, as they say. There are any number of ethics professors who have been interviewed about this. This was just an astonishing decision, because not only was he allowed to keep an interest in this company, but they supposedly set up some kind of committee. They've declined to tell me exactly how big this committee is and who's on it. But Ben Silverman, they will confirm, he is on it. So he is reviewing, participating in a review of decisions that directly affect whether or not his own pocket is lined.
In other words, he is both salesman and buyer.
He is salesman and buyer. And what has happened in the community is that people began to see a lot of Reveille shows get picked up on NBC's air, including some that Kevin Reilly had passed on when he was running the network, even that Zucker had passed on. American Gladiators was a show that I was told that Zucker had personally passed on, suddenly was back. Another example of that is Kath and Kim, which is about to premiere and was dead in the water, shelved by Kevin Reilly. And this was a show that not only was picked up by Ben Silverman, NBC under Ben Silverman, which he owns a piece of, but it was greenlighted without a pilot. Now, this is something that NBC has been trying to sell to the public as the new way of doing business in television. We are greenlighting series without a pilot. What we hear is Kath and Kim, we'll see when it goes on the air, has not gone nearly as well as NBC might have hoped and maybe turn out to be a real case study in why we have pilots. So, you know, to allow someone to say, I'm going to order a series that I am going to profit from and sell it to myself, that is not the usual thing in television.
What is his track record? I mean, for instance, did American Gladiators do all right?
It started out, you know, with a little bit of a bang and then not so good. And so far he has yet to find, you know, as a rival at another network said to me, where are the hits? And that's the question. Now, he, of course, has a bit of an excuse because there was a writer's strike. So he gets to say things were shut down. But from what we've seen and heard so far, there have been shows that didn't work and there are series greenlighted to pilot, which seem not to be working either, where people have been fired. There's a show called The Philanthropist, which he greenlighted to pilot with Tom Fontana and Barry Levinson. This is the talent behind Homicide: Life on the Streets. Well, at the time, they said they were greenlighting this to pilot because of their confidence in the talent. But they pushed the talent off the project before they even shot it. They said it was too dark. So I asked Ben Silverman myself, were you confused about who Tom Fontana is? What about Tom Fontana's past work would lead you to believe that this show wouldn't be edgy and gritty? And,
well, Oz was a very lighthearted look at
yes,
American prison
life. Yes, it was
hilarious,
wasn't it? Very amusing. So his answer was, I greenlighted on the basis of the script. And I said to him at the time, you know, as you know, I work for NPR. I said, the marvelous thing about radio is that I don't have to tell you what you said. I can let you listen to what you said when you greenlighted the show.
If you're just joining us, we're talking to NPR's entertainment business correspondent, Kim Masters, about NBC's embattled network chief, Ben Silverman. So these accusations of conflict of interest, first of all, I want to ask you, do you think they've hurt him?
I think that there is certainly a perception in the community, I've heard, that you would take a show, if you want to get it on NBC's air, you take the show to Reveille instead of going directly to NBC. And I think that does hurt, yes.
The second question is the real politic question, which is, in success, will these accusations matter even if they're true?
Of course they would not. I mean, in success, everything would be forgiven, as it was in the days of Indecent Exposure when there was embezzlement and everybody wanted to forget about it and there was that inconvenient breaking of the law. So yes, of course, in success, everything in this town, everything, I mean literally everything is forgiven. However, I think the feeling in the town is that nobody's convinced that success is going to happen, and I think the feeling is much more strongly that there will be the opposite of success leading to his exit from the company.
Now, there's a few vapor trails over some people's heads here. I'm going to ask you to explain what you mean when you say indecent exposure, because not everyone has your sort of ecumenical knowledge of television history. Explain what you meant.
Well, David Beagleman, who was running a studio, was found to have forged checks and stolen money, and he was successful. So the wish of the company was, again, a publicly held company, just let's not deal with this. And there was quite a struggle, and it's documented in a very fine book. But there are many cases where you see people who have done actually, I think, quite heinous things, and they are still working because of success.
Lest we paint too dark a picture of Ben Silverman here, NBC has hired this sort of young hep cat agent to shake things up. Certainly he's done that. What are some of the strengths that he brings to the table? And then I guess we can also talk about some of the weaknesses, but I'm curious sort of, you know, to get the full measure of the guy.
Well, you can see how bright he is. You can see he has good talent relations. You can see he has a sense, some instinct. Obviously, nobody is lucky enough to come up with a series of hits the way he has. But the first few times I heard that, I thought, wow, you know, he's firing off the numbers. He's working on new ideas. He's talking about, you know, partnerships with General Motors and how are we going to make money and what can we do that's different. The problem is that there just seems to be no follow-up and no delivery.
So is it too early to tell, or is it simply that the emperor may not be as fully clothed as we might hope him to be?
If I had to wager, I would wager pretty strongly against him at this point. I think that we haven't touched on the fact that, you know, there are a lot of missed meetings with Ben Silverman, a lot of rumors as to why those meetings are missed, a lot of speculation, open speculation. One of the trades even asked him about rumors of rehab. So there was a major quarrel. I mean, I'm sure you probably want to talk about the major quarrel with one of the town's premier agents.
Yeah, please. I mean, Variety has called him a lightning rod. Why is he conducting all this electricity?
Well, I think that, you know, there have been a couple of missed meetings. So that we even know about, and I've heard of others that we haven't been as publicized. He missed a meeting with the head of the Marvel studio, which had a little movie called Iron Man this summer.
Not one you want to blow off.
Not really one you want to blow off. And another meeting, and the agent involved was one Ari Emanuel, who will forever be known as the model for Ari Gold on Entourage. And Ari became very incensed. They had a heated confrontation in the dining room at Universal. And Ari has also been known to complain directly to Jeff Zucker about this way of doing business. And yet it doesn't seem to stop. And I think that kind of – when you have a trade publication openly asking you if these kinds of rumors are true, that alone has to be a problem for GE, even if the conflict of interest seems to have been something that they overlooked.
I'm wondering if you feel like even with all that, there is a part of this town that just doesn't like someone who's going to try and go a different way. I mean, to give the devil his due, everything you've said it may be well true, but he's also done things to shake up a business model that really was in deep trouble. I mean, immense amounts of money were being spent on television pilots that would never see the light of day. And here comes a guy who says, look, let's not waste all this money. Let's not throw seed onto rock. Let's plant where there's fertile ground and let's treat these things like they're almost like, in a sense, movies where you're asking brands to become investors in something and say, here's Christian Slater. Here's the script. Are you in? And I think that there's a certain part of me that wonders, is there somebody – how should I say this? There's a certain part of me that wonders that they hate him just because he is – trying things differently and threatening to upend the apple cart and to go about things in a totally different way. Is that part of it? Is that why he's so controversial?
I think you're right. It's very valid and true that people have a way of doing business here. And look, even if the business stays the same, they're all incredibly competitive and vituperative and they say snarky things about each other. But the problem here is this stuff has to work. And if Kath and Kim doesn't work and My Own Worst Enemy with Christian Slater, which is another one of these green-lighted straight-to-pilot, doesn't work or is expensive, goes through so many changes in personnel and problems that it's really expensive anyway, then I'm not sure that this new paradigm is going to be something other than a footnote to history.
Coming up after a short break, more with NPR's Kim Masters about beleaguered NBC programming chief Ben Silverman. You're listening to The Business from NPR. This is The Business, and I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner. NBC's Wunderkind programming chief, Ben Silverman, has been accused of being an absentee executive and partying way too much. And in Hollywood, that's saying something. His business dealings also created the appearance of a conflict of interest between the production company he used to own and the network he now heads. But some of the pushback may simply be the old guard, fighting the inevitable changes to broadcast TV that Silverman seems to both embody and embrace. I'm speaking with Kim Masters, NPR's entertainment business correspondent. We should point out that Ben Silverman's sort of famous salesmanship is rumored to have saved millions in production costs on a new show called Robinson, The New Adventures of Robinson Crusoe. I think the title has changed a few times. I think it's just Crusoe now. But it was shot overseas, and it's so much cheaper as a result of that that you can point to that and say, hey, look, we've saved millions of dollars on this. Therefore, it doesn't have to be as successful as if we'd done it in the traditional way. By the same token, you mentioned My Own Worst Enemy, where he's sort of brought on GM as a sponsor even before a single frame of film had been shot. That's very unusual for the television business. When you run a broadcast network, can you really manage for the bottom line? Or do you need to deliver enormous audiences no matter what?
Well, the one thing that broadcast networks have been selling all this time is we are still the greatest aggregator of eyeballs.
Do advertisers really need massive audiences in the end? Is that what they look to broadcast networks to provide?
I don't know if they need a massive audience, but I do think that if you want to distinguish broadcast from cable, what do you got, you know? Exactly. What is the difference?
Will the success or failure of this fall season that's launching in the next couple weeks determine his fate, or are his bosses, you know, the Jeffs of the world, the Zuckers and Immelts, are they taking the long view?
I don't think so. I mean, I think if you took the temperature in the town, this isn't my opinion, but the opinion of executives that I talk to, I think a lot of them feel that this deal is done. They feel that this is, that he's not having fun, that he might very well want to leave, that maybe it's just way too much of a demand and a drag. And, you know, a lot of this corporate stuff and meeting with affiliates and salespeople is just not that much fun. So I think there's a perception that maybe as he's tiring of the job, they're tiring of the negative press, maybe the lack of hits. And I think that I think a lot of people feel that if they don't expect this fall season to bring us any particular hits, and they then expect the door to be closed. Now, if that is not true and there's a sudden surprise breakout hit, that could change everything, or it could just provide him with an opportunity for a graceful exit if that's what he wants. Because as you pointed out, he is already a very wealthy man and he doesn't need this.
Now, the NBC shows that will ultimately determine Silverman's fate, Knight Rider, Kath and Kim, My Own Worst Enemy, and Crusoe, will premiere in the next few weeks. Kim Masters is the entertainment business correspondent for National Public Radio. She joined us in our studio in Santa Monica. Kim, thanks for being on The Business.
Thank you.
A postscript. In a recent interview with Paul Goff of The Hollywood Reporter at the New York Television Festival, Ben Silverman admitted that he might not have done such a great job handling the attention he's received since he got his network post. Quote, I may be the Paris Hilton of NBC, he said, but he added, quote, it's a job I want and I'm doing by choice. Which sort of throws people.
This summer, between honor and dishonor, between family and enemies, between July and August, a line will be drawn and then colored in yellow.
Don LaFontaine, the king of movie trailers, died September 1st at the age of 68. The business producer Matt Holzman has this remembrance and a look inside the business he leaves behind.
If you've gone to the movies in the past 30 years or so, Don LaFontaine was at least partially responsible for getting you there. And if you watch TV, you probably aren't aware that you've heard his voice many times a day. Don worked doing promo spots for almost all the networks and did hundreds of thousands of television and radio commercials, including ads for the biggest brands. But he finally became a star in a 2005 Geico insurance commercial in which he parodies himself.
When the storm hit, both our cars were totally underwater.
In a world where both of our cars were totally underwater.
From In a World to A One-Man Army, Don and his partner wrote many catchphrases for their trailer production business in the 60s, but for the most part, Don didn't voice them. In fact, Don's VO career didn't take off until his agent-to-be, Steve Tischerman, pushed the issue in the early 80s.
He was busy, and he was a big producer, and he was going to produce, so he didn't have time to talk about voiceover.
But Tischerman persisted, even though there was a bit of a conflict of interest.
I'm submitting him to his competitors. And at first, there was a coolness to it, until some of the studio executives, the marketing people, said, get that guy. So they had to hire him.
Pretty quickly, Don was making a mint doing voiceover, and his career as a producer went by the wayside. Eventually, he was doing maybe 70% of all big-budget film trailers and making millions.
I mean, at NBC, which is one session, he might do 30 spots. Each spot pays $250. Then you go and do three trailers. Three trailers may pay $2,000 apiece, $6,000. I think he told me once he did like 18 sessions.
And that's in one day. So why was he the go-to guy? Partially it was that he was the pro's pro. Steve Tischerman told me that one time he blasted through a session of 50 sets of 5, 15, 30, and 60-second spots. That's 200 spots in under an hour.
Let's say you're a producer at Paramount. You got an $80 million film back in those days, and $15 million you're going to spend on marketing. Nothing can go wrong. It's your job. So how safe can you be? You go with Don LaFontaine. Each year they would always try to find another Don LaFontaine or something else, and they would go through their number, and then in the end it was, okay, bring in Don.
Don LaFontaine had a special relationship with words, and he'd brought those words to movie trailers where they didn't exist before.
If you remember the old trailers, remember the wipes across the screen, the man who came to dinner, it's all the same. And Don, as a writer and producer, changed that.
The voice business continues to change. Because of Don and those that came after him, big voices have become so ubiquitous that many advertisers started to try something different. Many film trailers have gone back to using no voices at all, and often commercials have voices the public can relate to.
When you've helped generations of investors chart a course for the future,
the goal is to really keep the average listener tuned in for just a couple of seconds longer before they change the channel, before they get up to go use the restroom, before they hit the TiVo button to fast forward through the spot.
Tim Curtis is vice president of global celebrity endorsements at the venerable William Morris Agency. Ironically, these days, the everyman voice is often that of a celebrity.
Thank you, Hill. That charges our battery as we coast down your slopes.
If it's a voice that's familiar to them, it's whereas it doesn't automatically make you go, hey, wait a minute, that's so-and-so. It, you know, it really kind of keeps you tuned in like it's a friend talking to you, and then the message kind of sinks in a little bit deeper.
William Morris handles hundreds of big names who want to do voiceover.
The secret's kind of out of the bag. And it used to be there was just a handful of celebrities that were doing voiceover campaigns, but now it's really talent on every single level wants to get into the voiceover space just because it can be fairly lucrative. And, you know, all of their friends are doing it. And so, you know, everyone is very, very keen to kind of get involved in it.
Everyone thinks they can do voiceover, but Don LaFontaine got paid the big bucks for good reason.
We've had, you know, Academy Award-winning actors come in our booth and just not be good at it, and others are fantastic and take to it right away.
These days, instead of driving from session to session, VO people usually have booths in their homes. Clients listen to auditions on the web, and some say the quality and originality of writing, especially for movie trailers, is declining. People who can make those words sing, especially when they're not written very well, will always be in demand. And sometimes the everyman just won't cut it, so they'll bring in guys like Ashton Smith and Brian Cummings to take Don LaFontaine's place, and most of us won't really know the difference. Meanwhile, the man who was sometimes called the voice of God has gone on to meet the big guy himself.
Welcome to my world.
For The Business, I'm Matt Holzman.
And that's The Business. Matt Holzman produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. Our associate producer is Darby Maloney. You can listen to this or any past program online anytime at kcrw.com/thebusiness. You can podcast the show, share it with a friend, or embed it on your blog with the click of a button from our new media player at kcrw.com. And you can podcast the show through iTunes. Our email address is thebusiness@kcrw.org. The Business is produced by KCRW Santa Monica and distributed by National Public Radio. I'm Claude Rodesser-Ackner. We'll see you next week on The Business.